Our next speaker, we heard him talk earlier today at the parade, as well as JT, I don't think I mentioned that. He's the co-president of Madison's own Freedom From Religion Foundation, one of the sponsors for Free Thought Festival 2. Please welcome Dan Barker.
Thank you. What a fun group. Something is happening in the country, isn't it? Meetings like this are sprouting up everywhere. Skepticon and Aposticon is coming up, and all these student groups all over the country are just sort of bubbling up. Some of them think they're the only one. They start a group because they want to fight religion, and then they realize there's something happening. There is a real shift happening in the country, demographically, sociologically, where we all know that now the fastest growing religion in the United States is non-religion. So we all get to be a part of that. That's pretty cool. Wasn't always like that. Here in the University of Wisconsin, they used to have prayer at graduations. And every year people would get up to get their diploma, and then all the thanks was being given to somebody else's God, you know, for all their work. And a young woman who went to school here back in the 70s said, "Why do we have to have prayer before graduations?" And she thought, well, let me find out. She asked, "Why do we have the prayer?" And they said, "Well, the student committee does this. There's the student organization that runs it." So she went to the student committee and she said, "Why do you have prayer at graduation? You know, I don't believe in God, and a lot of my friends don't. And why do we?" And the student said, "We don't know. Why do we have prayer? We've always done it. It's been 150 years we've been having prayers before graduations." And she said, "Well, do we have to?" And they all looked at each other and said, "Do we have to?" And they said, "I guess no, we don't." So they scrapped the prayer. They stopped the prayer. There was no prayer at the graduation, and nobody missed it. And there hasn't been prayer at the University of Wisconsin graduation ever since then. Other schools in the state followed suit, saying, "Yeah, why do we have to do this? That's an old rule." That young student was named Annie Laurie Gaylord. She went to school here. And her whole life, she learned from her mom, just speak up. In fact, when she was in junior high school, here in Wisconsin, of all places, girls had to wear dresses to school. In junior high school. In Wisconsin weather, walking to school, walking about 4 or 5 blocks to school. In junior high school, Annie Laurie went to her school, "This is not fair, the boys don't have to wear, I'm freezing my knees off." And she complained to the school, and they changed it. Don't you wish it was always that simple? So Ann and Annie Laurie were fighting for women's rights. Ann Gaylor, Annie Laurie's mom, used to own a newspaper, the Middleton Times Tribune. She wrote the first editorial in the state protesting the restrictions on abortion, the first pro-abortion right editorial in the state of Wisconsin, as far as we know. But they noticed that every time they went to a hearing to protest or to testify about this, it was always the church over here. It was always these guys with funny dresses and collars over there, kind of standing next to the, like they were part of the state too. And so Anne got to thinking, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. This ancient Bronze Age religion from the Middle East is coming over here and trying to tell our secular government how women should be treated. And there was one meeting here in Madison at the city county building where they went to testify at a hearing. Ann and Annie Laurie, they just showed up and they said, "This isn't right. We need to fight for women's rights." But it opened with a prayer. And so Ann got up and protested. She said, "This isn't right. Here we are at a secular meeting, a city council, and you're opening with a prayer. Why are you doing that? This is wrong. You shouldn't be doing that." Some reporter went up to Ann and said, "Well, who are you? This is interesting. And, you know, what's your name? And do you have a group?" And Ann said, "Well, we're a bunch of people who just want freedom from religion." And the reporter said, "Freedom from religion, that's your group?" And she said, yeah. There wasn't a group. And so, but there was a story that ran in the paper. There's a group of people in Madison who want freedom from religion. She started getting phone calls, no emails back then, you know, from people saying, "How can I join your group? I want to join your group. Me too, I feel the same way. I want to join your group." And they said, "Well, then let's start a group." So they got these index cards on their dining room table and just started, you know, typing up names. And then I guess we have a group. And so she started typing a little newsletter to these people, and then it grew and it grew, and then they started with just three people. And then eventually the Freedom From Religion Foundation became incorporated and then became 501c3, and then went national in 1978, doing the same thing, just basically doing that same thing that that young student at college complained about, prayers before graduations. And Annie Laurie is still doing the very same thing all her life. She made a career out of complaining about things. And today, the Freedom From Religion Foundation now has more than 19,000 members, growing fast. We're growing so fast. Have you gone by our building? We're right downtown, just two blocks from the Capitol. We're growing so fast, there's no space. We have to expand, and we're in the process of expanding the building now. If you come back next year, you'll see a brand new, our original two-story building is going to have a third floor put on top, and then we're going to destroy the building next door and put a fourth floor next to that, all connected. So we're going to quadruple our space. So that is, I was going to say Lord willing, but I was going to say Urban Design Committee willing. We have to get through all these hoops in the city, but they've been pretty good about it, but there's still some problems with it. But anyway, so imagine doing that. It's kind of like what August Brunsman did with his campus club. He had an atheist club on campus in Columbus. He turned his campus club into a national organization, the Secular Student Alliance now, because somebody was complaining, somebody was activist, someone wanted to make a difference in the world. Carl Sagan was giving a talk before a university once. And in fact, we interviewed his widow, Andrianne, on Free Thought Radio, the radio show. And she told us a lot of stories about, how he died and what it was like. But Carl Sagan was giving a talk, and afterwards, the questions. A student went up to the mic and said, Dr. Sagan, if everything you say is true, then what meaning do I have in my life? And Carl looked at the young man and said, do something meaningful. Do something meaningful. Find something meaningful and do it. Do it. And I think that's kind of the theme of this whole conference. Do something meaningful. What Greta said this afternoon and what JT's saying. You saw that picture of James Randi that he put up there. I had breakfast with James Randi. We did a conference in Copenhagen 3 or 4 years ago. And so I said, James, you're a magician. Can you make religion disappear? And without missing a beat, he said, yes, I can, but you can't afford it. By the way, it was that same conference where Richard Dawkins came up with the idea of maybe starting a project to help clergy who want to leave the ministry. Now there's a clergy project, if you've heard about that. Now there's more than 400 clergy in the clergy project. And we just got, we're just raising money, and Todd Seifley gave some money. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is raising money. And I see Paul nodding, because he's one of the members. He's a former clergy, Paul Heffern from Minnesota. About 420. And don't just clap because he didn't do something. He's also a very talented musician. The Free Thought Band, and Jerry's there next to me. They have a Free Thought Band out of Minnesota, which we play on our radio show a lot. But just an idea. Sometimes just an idea comes to your head. And so now, with Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, and me and Linda LaScola and a few other people, this clergy project is just sort of bottom-up taking off. And about 420 members now, about a fourth of them are active clergy. And I was talking with a reporter this morning here in Madison who's writing a story about the clergy project. And he's interviewing one of the closeted, his name is Adam, in quotes. He's a conservative pastor of a southern church who's now an atheist, but he can't get out. He's stuck. He's just trapped in the ministry and wanting to find a way out. He's going to be the first recipient of our educational transitional grant, which is going to allow him to find some way to find new employment. And I want to call that project Save a Preacher. I would give money to save a preacher. So Annie Laurie started the foundation just loving it, just because it's the right thing to do. She had her degree in journalism, and that worked really well working with Free Thought Today. And now we have 13 full-time staff, including 4 full-time attorneys, and 3 of them are here tonight, right?
Yeah.
Andrew's here. Is Liz here somewhere? Where's Liz?
They're out too.
Liz and Patrick are out there. And they are busy. In spite of the cramped spaces they work in, they're super, super busy. How many complaints was that last year?
More than 2,500 unique complaints.
2,500 complaints came into our office from people saying, there's prayer at my graduation, or there's a nativity scene in my city hall, or you name it. The coach is putting Bible verses on the back of the baseball caps, things like that. You wrote more than 1,000 letters and had a lot, more than 100 clear victories, just without going to court, which is pretty neat, without even having to take a lawsuit to have a victory like that. So it's meaningful. One day I walked into Andrew's office. You can't really call it an office. It's a place where he has a desk. Someday he's going to have a real office.
It's a corner of the conference room.
Yeah, it's just a little. Anyway, he's not complaining because he knows we're trying to build more space. But he just spontaneously said, "I love this job," because he got some school to stop the students to stop bullying an atheist student in the school, and so and then there was a big memo, I guess, that went out and all that. But so I love this job too. This is the funnest job in the world. It's like state church separation, and then of course the foundation's other purpose is to educate the public about the views of non-believers. So I usually get sent on the road a lot, doing debates and speeches and concerts. And speaking of concerts, there's a piano here. And speaking of state church separation, I have a new song about town. This song was inspired by Governor Perry of Texas, where we protested his mixing religion and government when he had this big prayer rally. You remember, he's the governor who prayed for rain and then the state caught fire. So I dedicate this song to Governor Rip Van Periwinkle. He didn't sleep for 30 years. He slept for 2,030 years. If you find yourself to be a resident of the Capitol or of the City Hall, as governor or mayor or as president, you're a public servant to us all. You were not elected as our pastor in chief, and preaching on the job is not a perk. Govern us with reason and not belief. Get off your knees and get to work. Get off your knees and start thinking. The answers will be found right here on earth. Unbow your head and open your eyes. Get off your knees and get to work. It makes no actual difference what you say to God. He may as well be Santa or an elf. Every time you bow your head and pray to God, you are only talking to yourself. If you run your office with propriety, your First Amendment duties you won't shirk. Everybody's tired of your piety. Get off your knees and get to work. Get off your knees and start thinking. The answers will be found right here on earth. Unbow your head and open your eyes. Get off your knees and get to work. Get off your knees and get to work. Get off your knees and get to work. Well, since I'm at the piano, we have a brand new CD that the foundation just produced. It's called Adrift on a Star, which is a poem, now a song, that was written by Yip Harbor, the non-believing songwriter who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He wrote gobs of songs. It's only a paper moon. And on this new album is a brand new song. Do some of you know who the Broadway composer Charles Strauss, do you know who that is? Some of you know who that is? Of course, JT knows all the Broadway composers. Charles Strauss, he's in his 80s. He's the guy who wrote Annie, The Sun Will Come Up Tomorrow. He wrote Bye Bye Birdie. He wrote a whole bunch of famous tunes. One of my favorites is Once Upon a Time. He even wrote the theme for the movie, for the TV show All in the Family. Those were the days. Remember that song? We had him on our radio show, and then we offered him an award, and he decided to come and accept the award at our conference in Connecticut a year and a half ago. And it was quite an honor to have someone like that come. And he said, "I've been an atheist my whole life. I didn't know there were other atheists. I've just been keeping my mouth shut." You know, he knew Richard Rogers and worked with Richard Rogers. Didn't know that Richard Rogers was also an atheist. He didn't know that Cole Porter had to come out of two closets, actually. And so we were talking during dinner, and he got up to accept his award, and he said, "You know, I'm not much on speeches. Do you mind if I just sit down at the piano?" And, you know, so did we mind. It was like magic, you know. But during dinner, he turned to me and he said, "Hey, Dan, you know, my whole life I've never really written a song about belief or religion or faith or anything like that. Send me some lyrics and I'll set them to music." And I thought, yeah, I can do that. It took me more than 6 months. Because you don't want to just send any old, you don't want to just dash them off and send it to someone like that. Took him more than 6 months. I finally sent him some lyrics. And he said, "These are good, I'll set them to music. But do you mind if I do some judicious editing?" I said, "Hey, you're the pro." I mean, so he threw away like 2/3 of my words. But here is what was left. Dan Barker, Charles Strauss song. It's called "Poor Little Me." The multitudes mumble mythologies without end, but me, I have trouble with ologies that pretend to show what can't be shown, to know what can't be known. Lutherans have liturgies, Calvinists have creeds, Muslims have their minarets, Catholics have their beads, Methodists have methods, holy truth to ascertain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. Bishops transubstantiate, Shintos ring their bells, Transcendentalists meditate while Wiccans weave their spells, Hindus chant a mantra when they can't relieve the pain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. So fearful of the Netherland, believers band together, unhappy with the weatherman, the Zunis wave a feather. They dance in circles to demand great spirits send some rain. But what do you do if you only have a brain? Quakers quake and Shakers shake, and Jews eat kosher food. Rastafarians wear their hair in pious gratitude. They all boast of miracles that no one can explain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. They all boast of miracles that no one can explain. but poor little me. Poor little me. I only have a brain. So, if you have a piano, I'll come. any chance to do music and debates. I love doing debates, like JT was talking about. I did my first debate as an atheist in February of 1985, and since then I've been aiming for 100 debates. Well, I passed 100 debates last year, and my favorite so far was last November. In Oxford. I got invited to Oxford to do a debate for the Oxford Union, which is not only very prestigious, but it was a 3-against-3 debate, and they decided to expand our time. Usually it was 10 minutes each. We each got 15 minutes. And it was me, it was Michael Shermer, and Peter Milliken, who's a philosopher there in Oxford, against Peter Hitchens, who is Christopher Hitchens' Anglican believing brother, a mathematician, what was his name, the mathematician, famous theistic, and this Anglican priest woman. And it was a fun debate, and what was really fun about it was that afterwards, the proposition was, this house believes in God. And I don't usually get very nervous. I've done so many of these debates over the years. The first 10 or 20 debates you do are pretty scary, you know, it's like, you know. But after a while, you just relax, because you can't say it all in one night. But Michael Shermer and I were walking in to do the debate, and Michael Shermer said, by the way, Dan, Richard Dawkins is in the audience. Oh, we better do a good job here. So I have empirical proof, not only that we did a good job, but I have empirical proof that God doesn't exist. Afterwards, they're all wearing tuxedos and bow ties and very proper British thing now. Organizer, the president of the Oxford Society said, okay, now, those of you, we're gonna have a vote, but we're gonna vote like this. Those of you who agree with the proposition that this house believes in God, you exit through that door. Those of you who agree with the opposition, you exit through that door. And they had somebody counting. 142 people went out that door. 168 went out this door. So there's a vote. Democracy wins, there's no God, right? I did a debate in, I did my debate number 104 last Thursday night in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, with this guy named Joe Boot. And the topic was, is there life after death? So I really prepared for, you know, there's kind of two lines of evidence. I debated Dinesh D'Souza on that topic once. You know who Dinesh D'Souza is? Dinesh, in fact, Dinesh and I debated right here. What's that big auditorium right here on the other side of the Union, that big 1,500 seat? Anyway, we debated there. And the topic of Kara Newman, by the way, came up during that debate, the woman that you talked about. She's from Wisconsin, did you know that? Just outside of Wausau in Wisconsin. Dinesh and I, in fact, I'll tell you, I'll digress just a little bit. Dinesh and I have done 7 or 8 debates together. And we did one in Pennsylvania in early October. October 2nd is what it was, at Messiah College, a Christian college. We were invited to the president of this Christian college to her house for dinner. And so I'm the only atheist in there, and I love it when it's like that. I feel like everyone's looking at me like, but hey. And the Christian organizers were really nice and all that. And so Dinesh comes in, and he sits down, and there's a young woman next to Dinesh. And I remember I had met Dinesh's family in San Diego, like a couple years before that. We did a big debate in San Diego. So I was trying to think, where have I seen her? So during dinner, I just kind of decided to see, nobody's talking to her. So I said, so are you Dinesh's daughter? And Dinesh turned to me and said, she's my fiance. And I remember meeting his wife. And she looked like she was his daughter. And the Christian organizer sitting next to me, all their eyebrows went up, and they said to me, he told me he was bringing his assistant with him, but she doesn't look like an assistant. And the story broke. You probably saw the story. He was fired from the president of King's College. because this assistant, he, to save expenses, only needed one hotel room, you know. Dinesh is the guy who's written in a lot of his books that divorce and immorality and infidelity are signs of the evil sickness of secular humanism in America. You know, he's written all these things. I'm not going to begrudge, I'm not going to criticize his personal moral views. I'm not going to say anything about how he chooses to live his life or what, how, if he and his wife want to divorce, fine. But the hypocrisy of it. And so it later came back in the paper, well, she's my fiance because, you know, I'm getting a divorce from my wife, and who's to say you can't have a fiance before your divorce is? What's the more, you know, he's, you know how he's rationalizing. But he filed for divorce on October the 4th, after the story broke. So anyway, that's Dinesh. He and I, we did a debate in Cleveland, which I was going to turn down. It was a debate for Cleveland Right to Life, and they wanted to debate abortion. And I said, no, I don't want to go on a Saturday to Cleveland to a Right to Life conference and help these people, these, you know, extreme right-wing Christians. And Dinesh emailed me, and he said, well, can you please do it? And I said, but I don't want to do it. I mean, it's not quite for the foundation of what we do, you know. And he said, well, they're paying me $5,000, so I'll split it with you. And I said, you get paid for these things? I never get paid for these things. And so I talked with Annie Laurie, and she kind of agreed with me, but she said, what could we do with that $2,500? So I went to Cleveland. I did this debate, and it was... boy, was it weird. I mean, the people there, they were wearing this, I mean, they were all extremists, you know. And so during my talk, I got up and I said, a lot of you Christians out there, you're wearing these What Would Jesus Do buttons, right? And do you know that in the entire New Testament, Jesus never said one word about abortion? What did he say? Did the issue of an unwanted pregnancy ever come up in the Bible, ever? What did Jesus ever say about it? Nothing. So if you Christians want to do what Jesus did, keep your mouth shut about abortion. So I came home with a $2,500 check, and I signed it over to the Women's Medical Fund. The Women's Medical Fund. It's a charity run by Ann Gaylor, Annie Laurie's mother. It's the longest live abortion rights charity in the country. And it helps poor women pay for abortion. And in fact, most of them are religious women who call it. And Anne doesn't discriminate. She wants to help. When they call in Spanish, sometimes I take the calls to talk to the women. And I took one from a 19-year-old in Milwaukee who had three kids, whose husband was in jail, who's living with her mother, who's about to be evicted because she can't pay the rent, right? And she said, I can't be pregnant. I just can't. I love my kids, but this is, I just can't. So Cleveland Right to Life got to help that woman have an abortion. back to Windsor. Okay, how much time do I have? Six more minutes? One of the lines I like to say a lot, you know, I used to be a preacher, and people don't realize that the word reverend was a typo. Did you know that? The first letter was originally an N. Andrew laughed first, that's good. So I debated Reverend Boot, Joe Boot. He's a pastor in Toronto on Is There Life After Death? And but he had a car accident on the way to the debate, driving, how far is it from Toronto to Windsor? A couple hours, 3 hours? And so we had to start 90 minutes late. But I was all primed to debate life after death, because usually there's two evidences they give. You can imagine what they are, right? Actual evidences. What do they give when they're actually saying there is life after death? What are they?
Near-death experiences.
Yeah, near-death experience is a big one. That's what Dinesh did. That's why I started talking about Dinesh, because he brought it up during a debate. Near-death experiences. And?
Bible's true.
That's close.
I think you meant that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, the resurrection comes from the Bible, so you're right. It's the resurrection of Jesus is a historical fact, right? So if Jesus rose from the dead, there's life after death. So I was all ready for that. I had, you know, read up all this stuff about near-death experiences. And his argument was, he mentioned that, but he said, that's not important. The reason we know that there's life after death is because God does exist, and God said there's life after death. So no evidence, nothing at all, was offered as in anything you could rebut. And instead of discussing whether there's life after death, he said, The real problem is really the absurdity of atheism. So the whole debate about evidence for life after death turned into a debate about the absurdity of atheism. He accepted no burden of proof. You know, he's an attractive guy. He's articulate. He was holding his head up through the thing. He was feisty. It made a good event. These debates are really, it's better if you disagree a lot. You know, it's horrible to do a debate when you agree on too much. But it was a good show. It turned out that he had switched the topic on us. And I kept coming over, well, what about near-death experience? He didn't want to talk about any of that stuff. I was prepared to say this. Here's the near-death experience. You die, and you find yourself in this giant calabash, a gourd that you're trying to crawl out of, and you're in the middle of a yellow cornfield, and there's this blue train that comes up, and in the blue train there's Jesus, but he's big and fat, and he's got a red suit on and a long beard, and he's sitting next to Pope John the 23rd, who's sitting next to Superman, and he's sitting next to this wizard from a video game, and next to them is this little stuffed bunny from your childhood, and then there's this Hindu god Yamraj who has this ledger book, who's going through it and checking, oh wait a minute, there's been a clerical mistake while you're going over this, kind of over the city, and then somebody's pushing on you. And then there's a flock of giant rooster, and you can go on and on and on. That story that I just gave, does that sound like a near-death experience story? Have you ever heard that story? Well, you won't, because what that story is culled from actual reports. Actual reports from people who have been near death, and you could make that story 100 times bigger with obviously hallucinatory, fantastic, dream-like things that have happened. If you look at the literature of people who have reported near-death experiences, and by the way, only 10 or 20% of people who are near-death actually report anything, you could make a case. You say, well, you're just pulling pieces out of here and you're making this impossible story. Well, you know what? The standard model of near-death experience is the same thing. Raymond Moody, in his 1975 book, you've heard the story, oh, you're going through a tunnel and you see a light and you feel this presence and you have a life review and you feel like you're in this peace and you see dead relatives. That's usually what you think of a near-death experience. That's also a composite. Raymond Moody admitted in his book, nobody actually had that experience. He pulled kind of a tunnel from here. By the way, tunnels only appear in Western cultures and China and Japan. In Africa, there are no tunnels. It's like a big gourd that you're inside of. And so there's all this cultural conditioning. So the near-death experiences that people report, this thing, hardly anyone has more than two or three of those actual experiences, and yet it's a composite that we all, in our social understanding, we think that's the common near-death experience. It isn't. These other experiences just as well. The Mario Brothers, Einstein, and Elvis Presley, and all these impossible things happening. My mother-in-law, when she died, my first mother-in-law, my Christian wife's mother, when she died, she was in the room in... Carol was in the room saying she was talking about she was seeing her dead grandmother and she was at relatives, and she passed away. She died. I shouldn't say passed away. She died right just almost after that. But she said, I see these people. And they were all like, wow. Her name was Wilda, a really nice woman. And then she said, and I see Dan Barker up there. She saw me. I wasn't there in California. I was in the Midwest somewhere. I wasn't dead. But she saw me in heaven. So what does that tell you? People see things in near-death experiences that really don't correspond with reality. It's much more likely that the hallucinatory experiences of a dying brain are hallucinatory experiences of a dying brain. The brain is under stress and all that. But debates are one of the funnest things I get to do. I wanted to talk about the resurrection, too. I was all ready to tell you, he didn't even want to talk about the resurrection. Here's one little tidbit about the resurrection, and then maybe I'll end with a song, if we have time. When is Easter? It's coming up pretty soon? In a couple of weeks or so?
Into March.
We already went through the Lent. Right? Driving to work, when was that? When was Ash Wednesday? Like 2 weeks ago? Driving to work, the priests were out in Madison with... ashes to go. Really, I wish I had my camera. Ash, they're standing on the street corners with ashes to go, and you can go up there and they'll put the ashes in your forehead. I wanted to stop my car and say, can I get fries with that? You know, but supposedly the resurrection of Jesus is so powerful
it's a historical fact, the empty tomb. And I said, and I even said this at the Oxford debate, the resurrection of Jesus is probably the worst example anyone could possibly give. Not only are the five accounts contradictory, and not only can we show evidences of legendary growth as the stories, when you put them across time, grow in their telling over that first century. But one little fact which is quite fascinating. After Easter morning in the stories, Paul talks about he appeared unto Peter. He appeared unto the 500. The other gospel writers as well, they talk about how Jesus manifested himself. He showed himself. He appeared unto. That word appeared isn't used about Jesus before Easter. Before the Easter story, if you read the New Testament, Jesus met people, he talked, he was followed, he was seen, which is normal stuff, like you would describe any story, right? What if I said, what if you asked me if my neighbor was home, and I said, oh, yeah, my neighbor's home, how do you know that? Well, I went up to the door, and he appeared unto me. Then I went into the dining room, and he later showed himself unto me. You would think I was talking about a haunted house, right? You think, that's not the way you describe meeting somebody. He appeared again unto them, and that word ophthi from the Greek word horao, which is where the word vision comes from, and that word ophthi and appeared throughout the Bible. In fact, on the Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus took Peter and James and, was it just Peter and James? Who else did he take with him? Jesus, Peter, and James went up to the Mount of Transfiguration, and then Moses and Elijah appeared unto them. That same word appeared, and then he said, and they saw the vision. So it's always a vision. After Easter morning, if you have friends who believe in Easter, that was really a resurrection of Jesus, after Easter morning, you don't have these normal descriptions of this Jesus. You start having these ghost Halloween descriptions of him. He's appearing, and then he disappears. And is that how you describe a bodily resurrection? It's not. It's how you describe somebody that you think. It's like you think you saw grandma. My dad, after my mom died, my dad actually heard her voice calling his name. And my dad was an atheist, so was mom by that time. And he said, this is weird. I know she's not calling me. I know she's dead. She's gone, but I hear her voice calling me. Carl Sagan even said that about his parents, that he had that his brain was doing these tricks. So if somebody dies that you love and you still think they're there, you describe it in more kind of spooky terms, sort of Halloween kind of terms. So there's one evidence right there that the resurrection of Jesus at least wasn't bodily. It was not a bodily resurrection. And Paul even says in the New Testament, flesh and blood can't inherit the kingdom of God. All of these supposed post-resurrection appearances, and there's that word, appearances, They didn't say, oh, Jesus came up and shook their hand, and none of that. Well, it's a little bit of that, but mostly it's the appearances in that. So there is evidence from the Bible itself against the claim that there was a bodily resurrection of Jesus. How many pulpits on Easter morning are going to mention that fact this year? Let me end with one song, and then I'll. We might have a minute for questions. Is that water still there? A song that was inspired by a book that Richard Dawkins wrote. He wrote a book called Unweaving the Rainbow, and I've heard him say that that was his favorite of all his books. Have you read Unweaving the Rainbow, some of you? A short little book, but just really amazing. Because Newton was charged with taking all the mystery out of light, he unwove the rainbow. Now it's not mysterious anymore. Now, what are you trying to destroy the mystery of life by explaining it with science? How dare you? And Dawkins is trying to say that, let's unweave the rainbow. It makes it even more impressive, more magnificent, more enjoyable. And in his book, he says, to make it more accessible, maybe we should have more of the arts incorporated with science. If you could have more science in the arts, and those of you who are artists, if you want to do what Carl Sagan said and do something meaningful, then use science in your art, in your expressions. So I wrote a song based on his challenge to do that, trying and failing to copy Cole Porter's facility with words, but still a song that it's just a love song, and it assumes just the fact of evolution. It's called It's Only Natural. Thanks to Galileo for showing us our humble place in outer space. And thanks to Mr. Darwin for showing us the origin of the human race, which means that our precious romance is mainly the product
of chance. And these feelings of love, so frenetic, are just genetic. It's only natural that I would want you. It's only natural that you want me. A million years of evolution had its way. So we can blame it on our parents' DNA. I move instinctively in your direction. Somehow you signal me to turn and see. You will always be my natural selection. As a voluntary choice, if there is such a thing as free will, naturally.
All right, yeah, we have 7 minutes for Q&A. Raise your hand if you have a question for Dan Barker. I'll get around to you. We're stunned into silence by that great song.
Yeah.
How about telling us how you met Annie Laurie?
How I met Annie Laurie. I was preaching for 19 years. I was an atheist in summer of 83. I came out in December of that year. I started reading books. I read a book by a young woman named Annie Laurie Gaylor called Woe to the Women, The Bible Tells Me So. And I said, wow, I never read the Bible like this. So I wrote her a letter thanking her, and she didn't write me back. But her mom did. Her mom says, hey, you got a good story. Why don't you write us an article? So I did, and a few weeks later, I got a call from a woman in Chicago. I was in California, saying she's producing a show, and they're doing a show about atheism, and so could I come and be on the show with Ann Gaylor? And the host was a woman named Oprah Winfrey. So I had never before spoken about atheism. I'd never, in anything. So I flew to Chicago,
And then I met Ann and Annie Laurie, and we have a videotape of the day we met, which is pretty fun. And I could see from watching that show, and you can see it online, that show's online, that Open Window show, that I was, not only had I never spoken about atheism before any audience at all, that was, you know, I had been preaching just a few months earlier, I'd never spoken before a hostile audience before either, and I really loved that. That was like, when you have a hostile audience, it just, you know, it's not preaching to the choir, it's like saying something. And so I can see myself like groping for the words, you know, that today they just flow out, you know, but I could see the very first time saying those things. And but Anne, in fact, Anne and Annie Laurie said they were a little worried that, you know, would I be okay and would I maybe reconvert on TV or something, you know. But you can see us just relax. And you can also see me and Annie Laurie kind of checking each other out. Just briefly, we're kind of, you know. And that's the day we met. And we showed that video to our daughter a couple years ago, Sabrina. And she laughed because we, you know, I had hair. You know, I was. Yeah. And Annie Laurie was feisty. And one of the audience members, they're Bible thumpers. And one of the audience members was calling her a witch. And it was good TV, actually. So that's how we met. And then we got married 3 years later. And in 2004 became co-presidents.
What do you think is the most perplexing or difficult argument for the existence of God to argue against?
Well, I think their biggie is design. It's not that you can't, but I think that's the biggie. That's the one you always come up with, right? To be prepared for that and all the different things they throw at you. I think their Achilles heel is the problem of evil. So if you only have a little bit of time, I think the problem of evil is probably before an audience anyway. It's a good line. But design tends to be the one that you have to know something about. You have to know something about science. And these things they throw at you are silly, and they're wrong, and they beg the question and all that, and they're uninformed. But I think intuitively most people think, well, the human eye looks designed, so it needs a designer, right? So. That's probably the toughest. I did a debate in Delaware a few years ago with Doug Wilson, this Calvinist, and I thought I'd heard everything. I thought, okay, now I've there's no question that's going to stump me. After this two-hour debate about the existence of God, this man came up to the microphone and said, "So I have a question, Mr. Barker. Are you a practicing homosexual?" And I don't remember what I said. It was something like, no, I'm not, but I wouldn't be ashamed. I mean, you know, but why is that even relevant or anything? So I think I tell the story in my book, don't I, in Godless, that now I know what I, if he ever asked me again, my answer will be, no, but now that I've met you.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. I don't mean to mean this as to bring everybody down here, but I really admire the work that you do and want to see it continue. Is there, have you given any thoughts as to contingency plan, worst case scenario, to make sure that the work that you and Annie Laurie have started would continue?
Yeah, and I appreciate that thought, you know, because really it's Annie Laurie. I get to tag along for the ride. She's the real driving force, and her whole life has been behind this thing. And you know, we're a democratic 501c3 organization with a board and with staff. And so I think it's like, you know, if a tree is cut, then the branches are going to still grow. I mean, you know what I mean? Life is going to find a way. And so there's enough interest and there's enough. We have a lot of young talent already on our staff that, you know. But it's democratic. Someone's going to have to be elected. And isn't Jim here? We have a council member here. Jim Coors is the chair of the executive council. Stand up so people can wave at you. Jim Coors is a scientist, worked at the university, so we have some qualified people, and we have a lot of policies, and so do you think we're in good shape, Jim, or do we, okay, good.
All right.
right, we're out of time, so on that depressing note, let's